Our reading this morning is from the Christian Scriptures from the book of John, chapter 20, verses 24 through 29. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. This is right after the resurrection. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and place my finger in the mark of the nails, and place my hand in his side, I will not believe." 8 days later, the disciples were again at the house, and Thomas was with them. The doors were shut, but Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it at my side. Do not be faithless, but believing." And Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." Thus ends the reading. I'm going to begin by saying something that I say periodically, which is to talk about how ministers in Unitarian Universalism have freedom of the pulpit. What that means is that, as they call us, the faith of the free, I am free here to speak my truth and my conviction without fear of being censored by you, the congregation. And what you have is freedom of the pew, which means you are free to believe whatever you do believe and to disagree with as much of what I say as you choose. So let's just begin with that understanding together. Now, there are limits, right? There are limits to the freedom of the pulpit, because if I got up here and I preached hate to you, you would quickly say, "This is not our minister," and you would show me the door. But I wanted to be clear that I speak for myself when I speak of my faith, and I am not pretending to speak for you. I am just sharing what I know for myself in hopes that it might be useful or informative or in other ways motivational or to inspire some new thoughts or new action. We often think of faith and doubt as opposites. But what I want to talk to you today about is faith and doubt as complementary, of doubt as a part of faith. Faith, for me, is about mystery and awe and wonder, and doubt is an important piece of that. Kenneth Leech, an Anglican priest, says this: "True faith can only grow and mature if it includes the element of paradox and creative doubt. Such doubt is not the enemy of faith, but an essential element in it. For faith in God does not bring the false peace of answered questions and resolve paradoxes." But nevertheless, the idea that you have to have faith and doubt is not allowed is an idea that is prevalent in our culture, and it does have some root in biblical passages. But it's also true that followers of God and followers of Jesus have doubt, and that too is rooted in the Jewish and Christian scripture. It's particularly there in Jewish scriptures. Doubt is there when Jacob wrestles with God. In Psalm 88, the psalmist writes, "I call to you, Lord, every day. I spread out my hands to you. Do you show your wonders to the dead? Do their spirits rise up and praise you? Is your love declared in the grave, your faithfulness in destruction? Are your wonders known in the place of darkness, or your righteous deeds in the land of oblivion? But I cry to you for help, Lord. In the morning, my prayer comes before you. Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me?" In the Bible, even when people believe in God, there can be doubt. There can be doubt as to whether or not God will fulfill his word, for example. Abraham is a man of faith, but Abraham doubts when God tells him he will, doubts that God will really give him a son. And Sarah, she laughs at this news in her disbelief. And so Abraham decides to have a son with his wife's servant, Hagar. We could talk about that some other day. Talk about politics. And Moses' followers grumble through the desert, doubting that they're ever really going to get to the promised land. Yet they follow on. And doubt is there in the Christian scriptures as well. Doubt is there in Jesus. It's doubt that's with him when he wanders for 40 days and nights in the desert. And doubt is there with him on the cross when he says, "My Lord, why have you forsaken me?" The reading I shared was about Thomas, the disciple who's often held up as a negative example of doubting. He's called Doubting Thomas for not believing that Jesus had really risen until he felt his wounds. But the thing I've already always gotten from that story was Jesus' response. Jesus knows Thomas doubts. He knows that when he walks into the room. He knows that this man who has followed him doesn't believe that he has come back from the dead. So what does he do? Does he just say, "Thomas, you're damned to hell for not believing that this is really me"? No. Rather than condemn Thomas, he subjects himself to Thomas's need for proof and shows to him the things that Thomas needs to see. Another example of how Jesus responds to doubt in the Bible is in the book of Mark in chapter 9, when a man asks Jesus to cure his sick son. And Jesus says to him, "All things are possible for one who believes." And the man says to Jesus, "I believe, help my unbelief." And Jesus cures his son. In that man's moment of despair and doubt and questioning and confusion, Jesus just cures his son. "I believe, help my unbelief." What does that mean? It means we can believe and not believe at the same time. It means what's more important than absolute belief and certainty is wrestling with doubt and the willingness to engage in the struggle. I will oftentimes say that I'm not a Christian because I don't believe. I don't necessarily believe in God. I don't believe in resurrection. I don't believe in miracles. But in truth, if you ask me and you have the ability to sit and listen for about 15 to 20 minutes, I'll tell you, I am a Christian. I'm just not one as our society understands it. Because I seep myself in the tradition, I listen to the stories, I look to Jesus as a role model, I try to live the best life I can, and I wrestle with my unbelief all the time. And I live in that paradox of doubt and certainty, doubting the existence of God, believing in the existence of all-powerful love. I've never understood those who say that Christianity requires people to simply have faith, to simply believe when they have doubt and to never have any doubt. And there's no explanation for how to move from doubt to faith, except, well, you just have to believe. That's never made sense to me. The only thing that's going to move me, as I know it, from doubt to faith is being able to feel things for myself. And if there's God, God knows that. Enough said. God's okay with it, right? That's me. As a bit of an aside, doubt is there in other world religions too. Doubt is there in Islam. People think of Islam as all about certainty. But doubt is there. When the prophet Muhammad was visited by the angel, his first reaction was to doubt it. Leslie Hazelton, a biographer of Muhammad, has said, "The more I thought about it, the more it made sense that he doubted. Because doubt is essential to faith. Abolish all doubt, and what's left is not faith, but absolute heartless conviction. You're certain that you possess the truth, and this certainty quickly devolves into dogmatism and righteousness." Right. While much of our culture continues to define faith as certainty and belief, when you dig a little deeper, you hear that there are many prominent religious people who acknowledge their own doubt. A few years ago, the Archbishop of Canterbury in the Anglican Church, Justin Welby, said, "There are moments, sure, when you think, is there a God? Where is God?" He also said, "It is a really good question. The other day I was praying over something as I was running, and I ended up saying to God, 'Look, this is all very well, but isn't it about time you did something if you're there?'" Which is probably not what the Archbishop of Canterbury should say. I have to disagree there. I think that's exactly something that the Archbishop of Canterbury should say. But another example. Several years ago, some letters and writings of Mother Teresa's were revealed. And in one, Mother Teresa wrote, "Lord my God, who am I that you should forsake me? The child of your love, and now become as the most hated one, the one you have thrown away as unwanted, unloved. I call, I cling, I want, and there is no one to answer. No one on whom I can cling. No, no one. Alone. Where is my faith? Even deep right down in there is nothing but emptiness and darkness. My God, how painful is this unknown pain. I have no faith. I dare not utter the words and thoughts that crowd in my heart and make me suffer untold agony." Leslie Hazelton, that biographer of Muhammad, says, "We have to recognize that real faith has no easy answers. It's difficult and stubborn. It involves an ongoing struggle, a continual questioning of what we think we know, a wrestling with ideas and issues. It goes hand in hand with doubt and a never-ending conversation with it, and sometimes in conscious defiance of it. And this conscious defiance," she says, "is why I, as an agnostic, still have faith. I have faith, for example, that peace in the Middle East is possible, despite the ever-accumulating mass of evidence to the contrary. I'm not convinced of this. I can hardly say I believe it. I can only have faith in it, commit myself to it, to the idea of it, and do this precisely because of the temptation to throw up my hands in resignation and retreat into silence." She says, "Because despair is self-fulfilling. If we call something impossible, we act in such a way that we make it so. And I, for one, refuse to live that way." Another one of my favorite theologians, Cornel West, says this, "For me, there is always a dialectic of doubt and faith, of skepticism and the leap of faith, so that I am much more influenced by Pascal or Montaigne, who are both part of a particular tradition of faith, but who understand that doubt is inscribed within faith." Also, he writes, "Despair and hope are inseparable. One can never understand what hope is really about unless one wrestles with despair. The same is true of faith. There has to be some serious doubt. Otherwise, faith becomes merely a dogmatic formula, an orthodoxy, a way of evading the complexity of life rather than a way of engaging honestly with life." So, having established, at least for myself, that doubt is a part of faith, let me talk about the things that I have some certainty in, those elements of faith that I believe knowing I could be wrong and that I cannot prove them, but that somehow to my core feel they must be true. Because while I may have doubts about God and doubts about resurrection and miracles, I do know what it means to have belief. To hold something with certainty, to hold on to it even when the world around you is telling you it cannot be true, that it isn't logical, and that you are foolish for believing in it. For one, I believe that people are basically good. I have no proof of this. People do a lot of nasty things. People kill, and they rape, and they tweet. But I believe people are basically good. I believe Anne Frank was right when she said, "It's really a wonder that I haven't dropped all my ideals because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry out," she said. "Yet I keep them because in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. Anne Frank said, I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the sufferings of millions, and yet if I look up into the heavens, I think that it will all come all right, that this cruelty too will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again. I believe she was right, even though the world seemed to prove her almost instantly wrong. And do I have my doubts? Of course I do. You bet I do. Every time there's an atrocity, every time there's a pain of an act that can only be described as evil, I have doubts about the nature of humanity. But I have faith, I have belief in their goodness. I believe in love. I believe that the motive force of the universe is love. I believe that somehow under everything, in every cell, in every atom, in every particle and part of the universe, there is some bond of love that holds everything together. And I know this makes no sense. It makes no scientific sense at all. Yet I believe it anyway. Do I have doubts? Yes. When the world is filled with hates, I have doubt about this faith in love. I wonder if I'm wrong. And there's just nothing that lives at the core of existence. I wrestle with nihilism, but I choose to have faith in love. I believe in justice. Theodore Parker said, I do not pretend to understand the moral arc of the universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but a little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I can see, I am sure it bends towards justice. Sometimes I don't see the curve at all, but I believe he was right. I believe that somehow, and heaven knows how, we will get there to a world, a universe more just. I can't see the path always, but I believe it's there. Are there doubts? Absolutely. There are so many times in our society when it feels like we are bending that arc backwards from justice and equality. I have my doubts, but I choose to believe that the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And I believe in hope. I believe in that thing with feathers that flutters in the soul. I believe in that hope that has teeth and claws and is tenacious and fights back against the encroaching despair, even when it's 99% sure that your hope will be futile. I believe in hope. Even when there's no reason to believe that something is going to get better, or someone is going to get better, or that something is going to turn out for the good. I believe in hanging on, because just like doubt doesn't mean your faith doesn't exist, hope, the facts don't make hope go away. The unlikeliness of the good outcome don't make hope go away, doesn't make hope go away. It's a choice. It's not logical. It sometimes makes no sense at all. It's frankly ridiculous. So, yes, it's ridiculous. I choose hope. In the end, faith, religion, for me, that's back to the me again, all of this is really, it's about wrestling with God, like Jacob did. Faith is about having doubts and hanging on to something anyway. For some people, that is God. For me, it is the motive force of love, the power of hope, the arc of justice, and the inherent goodness at the core of life. May they be so. Our closing hymn is number 354, We Laugh, We Cry. Please stand or sit, whatever you feel moved to do.